Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Sue Desmond-Hellman, Chancellor of the University of California, San Francisco, and your moderator for today's program. Today's program is part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. It is also being held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce today's special guest, Dr. Joseph B. Martin. Now, Dr. Martin's book title tells you a little bit about who he is, Alfalfa to Ivy. So how did a farm boy from Canada get to be the Dean of Medicine at Harvard Medical School? And you might ask here in the audience in San Francisco, how did he get to be Dean and Chancellor at UCSF? So what I read Dr. Martin's book, and what I loved most about it, and what I know you'll hear from him today, is some unique perspectives. Somebody who grew up on a farm. Although his parents were American, he was born and raised in Canada. So a really not born with a silver spoon in his mouth. He's a real guy. So he brings a perspective of somebody who grew up in a really interesting way, but then enters a life that included experiencing a medical system in Canada, really important to a lot of the discussions we're having today. And while starting out wanting to be a doctor, ended up both as a researcher and as administrator, having a very unique point of view on today's modern medicine. I would say the good, the bad, and the ugly. And yet, in his book, he has this upbeat, optimistic attitude where he's bringing solutions to the problems we're all talking about. And so it is really my pleasure to be here today and to introduce Dr. Martin. I know you'll all enjoy his comments. And just a reminder that there'll be time for questions, so please be thinking of your questions. But now, please join me in welcoming Dr. Joseph B. Martin.
Thank you very much, Sue, for this for that wonderful introduction. Far too kind. I've got to know Sue well over the last 3 years since she's assumed this important role as Chancellor at UCSF, and I have enormous admiration for the leadership she's already shown here during that period of time. And indeed, last night we celebrated at the Mission Bay campus the annual Foundation Day event, which honored four individuals for their extraordinary contributions to UCSF, some of them internal and many of them external. Well, I did grow up on a farm in Alberta, Canada, about 100 miles east of Calgary on literally the Trans-Canada Highway, which in those days was a two-lane gravel road. And during World War II, at age six, I recall standing along the road as American troops and armored vehicles and soldiers were transported by my house to Alaska during the conflagration that involved, obviously, Japan. And I remember thinking then about war and wondering how a war could last for 6 years. How could it just go on and on? And from that time onward, I wanted to be a missionary doctor. Thought I would like to go somewhere and help people. And my parents, neither of whom had finished high school, were very encouraging and supportive. I ended up going to the University of Alberta Medical School, and then later trained in neurology here in the United States, did a graduate degree at the University of Rochester, and then, as Sue mentioned, took my first job as a real doctor and professor at McGill University in Montreal. So today I would like to tell you about some of my reflections, which really are reflections that go back 20 years or more. I was here at UCSF during Hillary Clinton's efforts at healthcare reform back in the early 90s. And I've been very engaged in a number of ways about this issue of healthcare. Last week, as you all know, the Supreme Court heard opinions regarding the constitutional validity of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. No matter what the court ultimately decides, the act is a disappointment. I had hoped for a bipartisan, more collaborative approach to issues of public entitlements and the escalating dysfunction and cost of our healthcare system. Polarization has only grown across the political spectrum. Hopefully, it is not too late to contemplate what might have been possible in health care reform during the Obama presidency, but the signs are not encouraging. The Affordable Care Act was a compromise, a modest effort to secure improvements in health care insurance availability, including the requirement, modeled on what has been done in Massachusetts, of mandating that nearly everyone obtain health insurance coverage. However, even if the Supreme Court lets stand the current law, I think there are three remaining issues that have not been adequately addressed and which demands our attention as we look forward to how to make this healthcare system work. And the three of those are administrative costs through inefficiency. The second is the lack of primary care networks and a healthcare system that is accessible to everyone. And the third is the unsustainability of the costs of a fee-for-service system in which all the incentives are to do more and to do more expensive tests and to do the tests that bring back a profit. So let me begin with the administrative cost issue, which are brought about by the inefficiencies in the current billing and fee structure. I believe we could reduce a substantial proportion of healthcare expenditure, somewhere between 15 and 20%, by adopting simplified health insurance claim forms. Office staffs in doctor and hospital offices juggle dozens of different insurance forms. A typical office practice with two physicians hires six assistants, but four and a half of them spend their time handing paper in and out, handling the paperwork and not dealing with patients. According to the American Medical Association, one in every five medical insurance claims are returned from the insurance because of inaccuracies or needs to fix something. The result is time wasted by physicians and their patients in attempts to adjudicate these clerical errors. I remember when I started my first practice in Montreal in 1970. Medicare had just arrived in Canada that year, and each patient was given a card, like a card you use at the gasoline station in those days, and each doctor had a machine. And the forms that we used had two parts. You put the credit card or the insurance card into the machine, pushed it forward and back. You took one of the two pieces and mailed it to the Quebec government, and payment came in 30 days. The other half you put in the drawer, and a single secretary could manage the whole business. That was the Canadian system back then. I hope we'll have some questions about that perhaps at the end as it is now. But I must say that if you look at the Canadian population as a whole, 60 to 70% of them are very happy with the situation. Of course, the issues of access and timely care and elective procedures being delayed are issues that Canada is dealing with, but the majority of the people in Canada are very happy with the system that they have. A second step might follow. Insurance for most patients could be offered on a single basic health insurance plan, you know, like base rate cable television, offered by multiple payers, the federal government through Medicare or Medicaid, private insurers, self-insurance, or a combination of employer and employee contributions. A simple basic benefits plan provided through multiple players would get around the widespread opposition in the country to a single-payer system. To this base rate could be added a surcharge for more costly, complete, or convenient services, such as open access to more specialists, broader drug coverage, more frequent checkups, more comprehensive preventive measures, and coverage for long-term care. It's not a surprise that there are countries all over the world that have this already. There are the Netherlands, Switzerland, Germany, France, Australia, have a support that covers everyone of a basic plan where private insurers can provide additional care if required. And of course, there are rules that regulate the plans which say that everyone has access. There are no pre-existing conditions that make you uninsurable. The insurance is transportable from one town to another, and indeed in Europe now across many of the country lines as part of the European Union. So I think we should listen to and learn from the experiences of other countries and try to find something that works better than what we currently envision. Let me talk now about the second point, primary care networks and the health of the public. There is a failure to develop an adequate primary care network or infrastructure. As an educator, I am fascinated by the current employment trends of medical school graduates and the failure to organize appropriate primary care systems. Today, most graduates of medical schools, including UCSF and Harvard, show little interest in primary care. Most specialize, and only a few choose to go into rural areas or to serve the less fortunate in our society. We have an acronym now that says our students are hitting the road. R for radiology, O for ophthalmology, A for anesthesiology, and D for dermatology, where the lifestyle is better and where the payments are appropriate for the services rendered. So only a few of our students go into rural areas, and most of them congregate in cities, and we all understand why that would be, but the finances of debt repayment, which our students have in large numbers now, and the differential between thinking for which you get paid very little and doing for which you get paid more, that needs to be corrected. Under urgent consideration today is the question of whether we have enough doctors to care for our patients, particularly if we move toward a more universal health care coverage system. The Association of American Medical Colleges is requesting medical schools to increase their enrollments in the next 7 to 10 years by 30%. There are fields like general surgery where serious shortages are expected, particularly in smaller urban centers and rural districts. And in view of an aging population, there will be an increasing demand for geriatric medicine. There is grave concern about the lack of primary care doctors to work in settings where the patient load is high and the pay is low. Let me tell you a little bit about the workforce as we currently have it today in American medical schools and in our training programs which follow medical school. Each year, the U.S. medical schools, of which there are now 140, graduate about 18,000 students. We welcome another 7,500 foreign medical graduates into the residency training programs into the first year slots. 80% of the foreign medical graduates remain in the United States. The impact of these graduates entering the U.S. workforce is twofold. First, permanent residency in the U.S. deprives their home countries of the workforce required to deliver adequate medical care there. On the other hand, while the majority of these foreign medical graduates also specialize, many of them seem willing to work in rural and underserved parts of the country. So what will we do to deliver the quality of care expected and deserved by our patients? How will we increase our focus on the importance of prevention and public health measures, encouraging parents to vaccinate their children, supporting major initiatives to stop smoking, and developing regimens for weight control that actually work? I believe the answer is not to train many more doctors, but to give those we train the right jobs with pay commensurate with the contributions they make. We need to discuss and address the disparity in reimbursement where doing procedures pays well, as I've already said, but thinking deeply about a patient's problem leaves financial penalties. New models of patient-centered care would benefit from a focus on teamwork, where, for example, doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and social workers form a work setting together. We must reorganize the hierarchy of care to include a larger role for nurse practitioners and physician assistants. We need to allow the physicians the time to do the work they were trained to do and what they want to do, namely taking care of ill patients who need their attention, with less paperwork and more pay. Unless we address both issues, we will continue to see a decline in the number of our students willing to enter primary care medicine. Finally, and this is a suggestion that I have not heard anyone else make, in this context, we ought to explore new locations for the delivery of primary care. One solution comes to mind. Why not organize certain aspects of preventative care and primary care in our public schools, providing health care alongside education in a setting where that could transform our efforts? In general, I think at least in suburban parts of the United States, our school facilities are really quite excellent, and it would be a wonderful location to deliver some of the primary care that patients now often seek at Walmart or CVS or one of the other settings where they walk in. How about having it organized where families could get care in a setting where the children were also being educated? So that's the conclusion of point two. Let me then move to point three, the unsustainable medical care costs. The recognition of the unsustainability of escalating costs in a payment system that rewards excess utilization by doctors and healthcare institutions, driven by a fee-for-service reimbursement structure, is simply unsustainable. Anyone involved in care, individual doctors, departments of academic health centers, and the hospitals themselves, are volume drivers. These represent cost centers. Capital campaigns, which we all engage in for new construction, depend on doing more work, particularly the expensive type that generates the most profit. The opportunities for fraud in such a system are unlimited. The coding of the payment system in Medicare and in other private insurance categories can be gamed for financial advantage at any level, from patient to doctor to hospital to healthcare network. All the incentives are focused on making more money for the enterprise, not to improving access, except through increasing volume, or quality of care, which is usually a marketing trick, too often based on unreliable data. There are solutions to each of these problems of cost, many of them now being considered under pilot programs around terms like accountable care organizations. My guess is that if I asked any one of you to define what an accountable care organization is, you would have as much trouble as I would have trying to decide what it is. But in essence, it's a system where the amounts of payments given to the care of a cohort of patients, used to be called capitated care, but that's a bad word, will be based upon a global budget, so that the care of a group of patients will include not just care of their illnesses and pain for the care of when they're sick, but will help with keeping them healthy and doing things to make the population the most healthy that it can possibly be. We have had a good experience in Massachusetts as one of the few states that has moved toward universal coverage. 98% of our patients are covered, but the primary challenge in cost management has been that the enrollment in our emergency rooms has gone up 5 to 7% because we don't have a primary care network to take care of the patients who now have insurance. And so the inefficiencies, as you know, of an emergency room setting are not satisfactorily answered under the current system. So as a dual citizen, born in Canada, my parents were Pennsylvania Dutch Mennonites who had migrated with my grandparents to Alberta, I cannot avoid the conclusion that the health care reform debate points again to a fundamental flaw in this country's social values. There was an op-ed yesterday in the New York Times by Julio Frank, who's the dean of the Harvard School of Public Health and who was formerly the Minister of Health for the country of Mexico. 8 years ago, Mexico embarked on a plan to provide universal health care for all of its citizens. A country that has one-tenth the gross domestic product of the United States. Last week, they succeeded in developing a plan for universal coverage. The 25th nation, the 25th of the wealthy nations in the world who have such systems, we are the only exception. And the exceptionalist argument that the United States is different can no longer be justified when considering the burden of responsibility for the people of this land who suffer most from the failure of our leaders to address their needs. We are the only developed country which makes this tragic mistake, and for double the price compared to other countries. Thank you very much for your attention.
Well, thank you very much for that, and we do have many good questions from the audience. Let me just, before we get to the questions, remind the listeners you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Dr. Joseph Martin, former chancellor of UCSF, dean of Harvard Medical School, and author of the inspiring book, Alfalfa to Ivy, Memoir of a Harvard Medical School Dean. Many questions. Let me group some of the questions that are consistent with some of the things that you've been talking about, Dr. Martin. Can you comment on malpractice litigation and how malpractice influences insurance premiums and medical practice?
Thank you very much for that. And let me make explicit one aspect of what I'm suggesting as we discuss this together. And that is that there is no final good solution to this extraordinary problem, and that all of us are going to need to work together to find ways to make the broken system work. Many efforts have been made to calculate costs associated with various aspects of the healthcare system. And the best numbers that I've seen would suggest that the cost of malpractice litigation and the protective acts that physicians take to get tests and so on, to cover those possibilities, is less than 10% of the cost. It's probably between 5 and 7%. So it's significant, but it's not one of the most important. And I would emphasize another aspect that, with the talk of drugs and prescriptions, that once again the cost of drugs as a contributor to this, Sue, I think is in the order of 7 to 10%. It's not a major part of the total number either. So I believe in tort reform. I think that is something we should be doing to make it easier. My daughter, Melanie, who's a wonderful physician, works in North Carolina, a primary care internist who directs a clinic for the uninsured and for Medicaid patients. And when I watch the work that she does there and the way she tries to, even with that population, which probably are less likely to sue over malpractice, but I see her all the time doing tests that she just thinks she better do, even though she has a budget that she has to live in or live with, which makes that constraint for her, I can say, a personal issue.
So along the lines of, you mentioned that somewhere around 7 to 10% of medical costs are spent on pharmaceuticals. But this question really gets to how the pressure that may come from insurance companies or others to prescribe certain medications. Specifically, can you comment on the influences that are on prescribers to prescribe certain medications and maybe not others?
Well, this is a very complicated question. You know, we're the only country in the world that allows direct-to-consumer advertising of the sort that that you hear every day. When I see Cialis being presented to our children at age six, I wonder what in the world they think. You know, if you have an untoward event, be sure you see your doctor within 4 hours. Well, we have direct-to-consumer advertising that originally I think it was intended to educate And there are aspects of it which work pretty well in that regard. But if you look at the fair play between generics, which maybe 90% as effective as the most recent drug that just appeared, the pressures on all of the physicians and all of the caretakers are to go to the new expensive drug that's still under coverage by the company. Now, Dr. Desmond Hellman has had a lot of experience in this world, and I wouldn't want to be presumptuous about the problem that's been asked about here, but I think there are concerns on the part of doctors who really would like to have the best evidence for which drug is the most likely to be effective and the lowest cost. And that information is just not available. Now, we currently hear a term called comparative effectiveness research. That's the big Washington title for a set of activities that would allow one to compare the effectiveness of various treatments and do it in the most cost-efficient way. So far, not really very effective.
Yeah, no, I would add my editorial comment because I really agree that having the best medicine at the lowest price, but I know both Harvard and UCSF are very much engaged in precision medicine or more targeted medicine, and just as important as who gets the drug is who isn't prescribed a medicine that won't either work for them or could give them side effects. So I think that's really well said. So there's a question here, Dr. Martin, about something that is more positive about medication in a specific category. Contraception has been called one of the greatest medical technological advances in the last century. But there's been a lot of debate about contraception, and that's been a part of our national and political dialogue most recently. Is this debate more about medicine or something else? I think this questioner has a loaded question in mind. But what do you think about the debate about contraception and how it relates to the whole medical system you've just talked about so elegantly?
Should we have a vote? It's all about politics, but it's also about the interception of religious values and human society. So it's a legitimate topic. But it shouldn't be framed, I believe, in a way that limits access of those who have no personal difficulty with a legal, available drug for the behavior that they are engaged in. It becomes politically unfair, I think, to put this as an issue in the way it has been in the past few months. And I think that women, in particular in this situation, need to state very explicitly that this is a personal issue for them and for the families that they rear and so on, that this is a matter that should not be politicized in the way that it has been. I find it very discouraging to think that this is the kind of thing that frames a political debate when there are so many other things we should be concerned about.
So before we leave the topic of the kind of universal health care and the dialogue about health debate, there's a couple questions that I think are really in that area of question. One is about insurance companies, and specifically you talked about other countries in the world and how we're sort of paying more and getting less. One of the persons who wrote a question is asking about the insurance companies in the countries you talked about are not for profit. So how important do you think profit in the health insurance industry is in maintaining our high-cost system?
I love that question, and I'll tell you why. I have, in thinking about how to get to the 40%, let's say, that we pay above other countries of the same educational level, the same economic system, so we cost at least 40%, some instances 50% more. So I said already, I think administrative costs and their inefficiencies can account for half of that, 15 to 20%. So let me tell you how the for-profit world works. And this is all very public. A for-profit corporation that insures patient has what's called a medical cost ratio. A medical cost ratio is what the company pays to take care of the patients who are insured by it. The other 20% is profit. It's money to return to shareholders. If you take that 20%, and if you look at the guidelines that were being developed early on in the healthcare debate, now it was said we're going to regulate for-profit insurers so that they can't make more than 20%. So we're going to make the medical cost ratio, that's going to be a law, essentially. Well, I think that then, if we're paying for that additional 20%, we should have some evidence that it's better than what other systems would provide. There should be better access. There should be better quality of care. There should be something that would mark that as a superior system. And there's, as far as I'm concerned, no evidence for that. So I think you can add those two together and you get very close to a substantial part of what the additional costs are in this country compared to Canada, Japan, and England.
So along those lines, one of the models that we see a lot in Northern California is the Kaiser system, and it's obviously more broad than just Northern California. How do you think about Kaiser as a potential model for healthcare delivery?
Well, I was driving yesterday around the city admiring the wonderful landmarks and places that we loved to visit when we were here for 8 years. And we went by the Kaiser Hospital just off Geary Street, and I told Rachel, my wife, that there's an entity that I really have come to admire. When I was an academic here in the 1990s, we kind of looked at Kaiser Permanente as, they're really not very academic. They don't do research like we do. They don't discover cures as fast as we in the academic world do. But they sure have learned how to take care of patients in a way that provides the network that I think is so visibly lacking. I would add to that that there are experiments of that sort going on across the country now. Many folks will look at certain systems like the Mayo Clinic or the Cleveland Clinic or the Intermountain Insurance Company of Utah as examples of how the Geisinger Clinic model in Pennsylvania. And these are all excellent examples of how this kind of networking can be put together. The doctors are almost always on salaries as opposed to making what they do from the billing they make. Generally, their benefits are generous. And the patients in those systems are, by and large, very pleased with the care that they are receiving. So it's not that we haven't done some of these things in ways that are really getting at what we hope might come to pass, but we simply don't have an overall organized way to do it for everyone.
So let me remind our radio listeners, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Dr. Joseph Martin, former chancellor of UCSF, Dean of Harvard Medical School and author of the inspiring book, Alfalfa to Ivy, Memoir of a Harvard Medical School Dean. There are a couple of questions that I think are related to healthcare costs, but bring up a couple of separate topics that I think are very important. One is the whole issue of rationing, the whole issue of the healthcare as a right and healthcare as a privilege, and are there certain aspects of healthcare that are a right and others, as you alluded to earlier, a privilege? So that whole area of rationing, and one of the ways that concept of rationing has come up in this debate was something very politically charged called death panels. And another question here really gets to end-of-life care. And so could you address those two questions, because I do think they are related. What is the extent of care that should be delivered end of life? And when there are too few resources, as systems like in Canada have, or I assume in Mexico have faced, who decides and how do you decide who gets care, and what is a right and what is a privilege?
Well, that is an exceedingly difficult and complex issue to deal with. I think I would start by saying that we already ration care by access, by privilege to some and denial to others, so that the rationing is a fact. We just don't like to call it that. We don't like to admit that this country, wealthy as it is, would allow that to happen. Let me turn to the issue of physician-patient discussions around whether the next step in care is essential or best for the patient or best for the family. I think we have models of superb physicians and nurses and teams who work in settings like hospice care. And I've been involved with some of them and have enormous admiration for their approach to giving wise counsel to families and to patients who are in the end of life stage. We know that in Medicare alone, somewhere between 30 and 50% of Medicare costs go into the last 6 months of life. So we are paying enormous amounts to keep people alive at a time when good physician practice and good communication with families would suggest that a topic of that kind is appropriate and would be useful. The term death panels, which came out of the blue from Alaska, as I recall, is just a tragedy, because what the bill that was being discussed would have done was to reimburse a doctor for an hour spent with a family to talk about these things, to give advice and to answer questions. I mean, it wasn't about, you know, choosing a list and first 10 have to go. And it's an example, again, of the politicization of a healthcare system where these kinds of expressions become sound bites, which then become the public's framework for talking about these things without knowing what's really going on. So I think rationing is a reality. We do it with kidney transplants now. We do it with heart transplants now. We don't have enough heart transplants. So we have a list. And the list is prioritized by severity of illness and likelihood of dying for a heart transplant. And it is based upon a societal agreement, which is nationwide, that we will frame the question responsibly. There is a rationing available. I mean, it's a fact. And we're going to find a way to make that the best it can be for as many people as possible. And there's no argument about that system. Everybody agrees to it. So I think there are ways to work together to address this question. But in the meantime, there's no doubt that we are not providing everyone with the same level of potential care.
Let me switch gears a little bit, because one of the aspects of your career that I didn't include in your introduction is that you're a widely recognized neurologist and an expert on the nervous system and the brain. And something that's been in the news and on a lot of people's minds lately is autism, with recent data suggesting a marked increase in autism and maybe some new things about the genetics and etiology, or at least the epidemic of autism as it's been experienced. Do you have any opinions on the emerging data? And for the audience, how should we think about what we're observing in autism?
So let me just say that in my post-deanship years, I retired from the deanship at Harvard 5 years ago, and have been leading a center focused on the genetic basis of degenerative conditions of the nervous system, more in the Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Lou Gehrig category. But one cannot separate that kind of deterioration in the brain that occurs late in life from what is now recognized to be a deterioration in the brain that occurs earlier in life, such as autism. And autism, as you know, is something that very often follows upon a perfectly normal development for a year or a year and a half, and then a progressive decline. often to very tragic situations. Some of them are evident at birth, but most aren't picked up until between 6 months and a year, and even more often after that, between 1 and 3. The genetics of autism, which has been in the press this week, is just an extraordinary example of how quickly we are moving toward making absolutely clear the basis on which certain mechanisms of brain development can be thrown off by specific gene mutations, that is, one protein which gives the signals incorrectly to the developing brain to lead to what is called autism. Now, the truth of the matter is that these are rare and minor effects, so that they're not common. Even in the case of Alzheimer's disease, we can only, in that instance, account for perhaps 40% of Alzheimer's on the basis of genetics and portions of the genome that we know about that impact that disease. Autism is much less than that. It's probably less than 10%. But the point is that this is one way to actually move from clinical phenotype, what you see in the patient, to a mechanism that allows one to study how the brain development has gone off, and then to actually think about how to target that in the search for a therapy. So I think the autism literature is just extraordinarily fascinating and is yielding things that we would not. There are about 37 different known causes of autism now. Most of them are associated with other kinds of conditions, and a few of them are very basically genetic.
So as we're on the subject, and is there anyone in this audience who's not aging? Raise your hand. It's on so many of our minds, literally and figuratively, that as the population ages, we're going to have an epidemic of Alzheimer's disease. So as you've been focused on the genetics and the deepening the understanding of that particular type of neurodegenerative disease, how are you thinking, and what are your odds on us getting either a preventative, which would be amazing, but some therapeutic advance in Alzheimer's disease?
So let me begin with the statistical facts, which are that by age 65, somewhere between 5% and 7% of people are affected with Alzheimer's disease. By the age of 75, that goes up to close to 20%. And by the age of 85, it's between 40% and 50%. So the impacts of a decline in intellectual function, which can be shown in terms of what the brain is happening to the brain, is a very substantial concern in a population that's increasingly growing older. We now know that for those who unfortunately will develop Alzheimer's disease, that the process probably begins at least 10 to 15 to 20 years earlier. And the plaques and the tangles that you read about, senile plaques and the tangles which are within brain cells, appear now, we know, many years before the actual symptoms of forgetfulness, having trouble finding the car in the parking lot, which, of course, we all do sometimes. and these, the new techniques available to mark for this early on have become very powerful. And they include brain imaging, which will show selective loss of brain tissue in the areas that are important for memory. Can include changes in the proteins in the spinal fluid, which are associated with plaques, which contain a beta amyloid protein, or tangles, which contain tau protein, and new imaging techniques that use labels that actually will tag on to the beta amyloid in the brain to allow you to see it in a PET scan, positron emission tomography technique that allows you to actually make a measurement of the amount of amyloid that's deposited in the brain. I come to this because, Sue, I think the failure of trials so far, which unfortunately has been almost universally the case, is that we have started to treat too late. And it seems very likely that once one gets to the place where there's a lot of ongoing brain damage, that reversing that is not likely to be helpful. It's like having advanced atherosclerosis in your heart and in your arteries. If you started giving the statin drugs that we now take for hypercholesterolemia after the patient's fully developed that, it's unlikely to do much benefit. So we need to find a way to identify those at risk and begin the trials that, which I have some very good ideas underway already, to see if we can slow down the progress of the disease. Now, what's very disturbing to those of us in academic medicine is that many of the biggest companies have decided to back off from looking for treatments here. And I could name half a dozen major pharmaceutical companies that have in the last 6 months and months announced that they're going to just wait a bit, which has led in part to the federal government making Alzheimer's disease research a priority. And there's a large press going on in Washington now to try to increase the amount of funding for research in Alzheimer's disease. But I think it is fair to say that there's only one way to find an answer, and that's through science. And I think there is a tremendous commitment on the part of colleagues of mine who really hope that in their lifetime something will be found.
So while we're on the topic of science and going from autism and Alzheimer's to a more general question about science and technology, you've got a fantastic point of view on watching science over your career so far. So what do you consider the greatest technologic advance in the last 50 years? And really, what's made the biggest difference in medicine? And maybe using your crystal ball, it may be 25 to 50 years in the future, where do you think we're going in terms of science and technology? What's exciting to you?
Well, I heard someone once describe the 20th century as a century of the atom, the computer chip, and the gene. You know, we discovered physics early on in the 20th century, before that even. We discovered the computer chip midway through the 20th century. And the Human Genome Project, which was initiated in about 1985, and its first thinking about let's do all of the DNA in our bodies, was finally completed in a rough draft exactly 10 years ago. So I would say those three things are coming together in incredible ways to make possible the kind of research that we're now doing. And so I have described the 21st century as a century of the synapse. Now, how many of you know what a synapse is? Well, almost all of you. I mean, that's terrific. A synapse is that point of contact between two nerve cells in the brain, which allows communication to be transferred over circuits in the brain to produce the behaviors that we recognize in animals and in ourselves is fundamental to how we are able to do all of the things that make us human. We know now that disorders of synaptic connection are important for almost all of the conditions that we've talked about here today. In fact, some of the genes in autism that have been identified are actually proteins right at the level of the synapse, which means that that connection between the electrical signal, which comes to the end of the nerve cell at the synapse, which releases a chemical substance which then crosses the synapse to stimulate the subsequent cell, that some of the autism genes are in that machinery right at that point. Really important discoveries. So if you look at Alzheimer's disease again, it appears that the problem early on, at a time when you really would want to treat the disease, is that some of the proteins that are made in error as part of Alzheimer's get stuck into the synapse to block its passage. And so we know that synaptic connectivity in Alzheimer's is one of the earliest things to begin to fail. So I would say that putting together the power of physics, which is the atom, the power of information technology that allows one to think about the extraordinary ways to put data sets together so you can analyze the material that is being collected, together with the genes, may help us understand how the synapse works. So
That's great. I think the audience probably agrees with me. I wish you taught me neurology. this is the best description of a synapse I've ever heard. So maybe we'll spend a few minutes on medical education. That's a topic of a few of the questions. Comparing how we think about medical education to just higher educational thinking in general. So higher education is changing from teaching things to mentoring teaching students on how to learn. Will medical education also change in this way?
Well, I think it has changed. When I went to medical school, I remember vividly the first 2 years I sat in lectures from 8 a.m. until 5 p.m. every day. And I went home and I made notes on all the things I'd heard during the day, underlined, and tried to keep them in my head for the exam that would come on 2 months later. We don't teach that way anymore now. UCSF, Harvard, teaches students to a large degree in small group settings with around case material, patient stories, patient examples of illness that are given to students right at the beginning, first day of medical school. I tutor in the second-year medical school class at Harvard with a group of 8 students. We have 165 total in the class, so there are about 20 of us as tutors, and I spend during the brain course, which is 7 weeks long, 3 mornings a week with a group of 8 students working around cases, a case of epilepsy, a case of multiple sclerosis, a case of stroke, where the students hear the clinical story first and then go back to the science behind it and learn all about why brain discharges of epileptic sort occur and why treatments that we have for that work. And so I think education is moving very well into that new framework. Now, I think we still have a lot to learn on the wards where students see patients with super docs and specialists who are often attuned to the problems of medicine at a level that's very sophisticated for the ordinary student just trying to get a general base of knowledge. And we have a lot of work to do there. It's an interesting cycle for a medical career. It's a kind of ups and downs, if you like. You graduate from high school and get well and do well enough to get into pre-med. You start pre-med, bottom of the pack. By the end of senior year, you finally made it into medical school, and then you start at the bottom of the pack. And you go through 4 years of medical school, and then you're assigned as an intern, and you start at the bottom. And I think the seams between those components need to be worked on. I think we should be teaching many of the arts and early sciences of medicine in college, not to take away from general medical or a general education in colleges, but to prepare students in ways that help us discern the characteristics that we want in physicians later on. So there's a lot of effort in medical education. It's a huge example, I think, of how international efforts are coming together to make medical education, to produce the doctors who have the right qualities of personality and of care and of engagement in communication that will make them the very best doctors. I want to emphasize how important I think it is to teach students how important nurses are. And I tell the student who starts on the ward in third year, listen to the nurse. She knows a lot more than you do. And she will teach you things that you will value forever. So there's a move now, and this is happening in several medical schools, to actually put nurses and physicians and social workers into the same classroom setting where they learn teamwork and learn to share, and where the doctor hierarchy that we have all been accustomed to is is less evident than it was. And I think that's a very important direction for us to be taking.
Well, I invite you while you're visiting San Francisco to see the interprofessional educational area in the library at UCSF, because I think that's a very important trend nationally. And I know both Harvard and UCSF are leaders to that end. Now, there's another question here that has to do about education, but I'm going to broaden the question. The question raised, which I think is so important today, is about whether or not physicians and healthcare providers in general need more education about nutrition. And the questioner is really asking about America's consumption of sugar. But in terms of not only education about nutrition and whether or not it's sugar or anything else in the diet, but thinking about wellness and preventive medicine and keeping people well rather than treating sickness, how do you think about medical education as it relates to that sort of issue of wellness and specifically, in this case, nutrition?
Well, as so many of these questions have been, this is an absolutely critical query. The traditional medical education was about disease and how to take the syndrome of usually acute disease and know what to do to help the patient with a heart attack or a stroke or acute kidney stone and so on. And that really is not adequate. We need to be thinking holistically about patients as people, about societies as groups of people, and thinking about how we can make all of us healthier than what we are at the moment. You know, I've heard it said that 50% of disease morbidity and mortality could be addressed with 5 points. Healthy diets, exercise, weight control, smoking cessation, and alcohol in moderation. You can add your own to that. But if one could get the public to honor those kinds of common sense things, a tremendous impact would be made on the health of the public. And we don't teach that to our students in a way that's convincing.
So along those lines, just looking to the future, and we talked about a potential epidemic of Alzheimer's disease with the startling statistics you talked about, but also obesity and type 2 diabetes. They're going to put tremendous pressure on the cost you talked about before in the U.S. healthcare system. How do you think about approaching obesity and type 2 diabetes?
Well, I wish I had an answer for that one, and I don't. It is, I think, a tragedy to watch our society in its current condition of greater and greater obesity, and with it diabetes going forward. And I don't think that we in the profession have an answer to the best way to proceed. I think there's a lot of science these days that would suggest that once one gets into a state of excess body weight and the metabolism that accompanies it, that it is almost impossible to reverse that. And weight loss programs are notorious for short-term improvement and long-term return to the levels involved. There's a lot of research about the resetting, if you like, of the obesity or the hunger or the nutrition appetite, which is a very complex system of hormones and brain, and needs to in ways to perhaps intercept those signals or to change them to make the outcome better. I think it's a crisis that's bigger than Alzheimer's disease in our society today, and not sure how are we going to deal with it.
So let me, again, switch gears. What everyone in this audience and listening to the radio has in common is we're all healthcare consumers. As somebody who's been so deeply involved in academic medicine, if you put yourself in the shoes of a consumer, how would you choose a doctor?
I think a doctor's that all of us should have begins with a primary care physician who takes care of the whole of your health and your family. It's an old-fashioned family doctor type. And I believe that's where we currently lack the environment and the workforce to do it. I frequently get called in Boston to recommend someone to a primary care doc, and I can't find a primary care doc in Boston. The Mass General not long ago indicated that they would have no more room to take patients who are searching for primary care doctors, and yet Massachusetts has more doctors per capita, I think, than any other state. So we're trapped in this dilemma of, we know that patient-centered care, the patient home, which is the language you hear a lot about these days, should involve the situation where your whole every aspect of health in your life and your family should be part of the conversation with your physician or with the nurse, who often can do it even better than the physician. And we just need to get that structure together.
So because of this shortage of primary care and family medicine physicians, it's not uncommon, and I'm sure this relates to many of the audience, that someone will access their medical care by seeing a cardiologist having had a cardiovascular incident, or a neurologist if they've had something. And many today in the medical care system end up with a group of physicians. If you have entered the medical system with and have a group of physicians who are delivering care, how do you get your doctors to collaborate with one another effectively?
Yeah. Well, I think group practice is part of the solution here. And if you look at the models that get talked about, whether you look at the Cleveland Clinic or the Mayo Clinic or practice groups that I see at Harvard and Mass General and Brigham, the organization of that kind of group care really works very well. But somebody has to be in charge, and you can't expect a patient to come to the hospital for a given appointment and then to have to spend the rest of the day shuttling from one office to another trying to get each piece of the puzzle together. That simply is not the way to treat our patients and not the way to make a health system efficient. So I think we have a lot of work to do in that way as well. And group practice is emerging as one of the ways to contain the cost, where a group of physicians would take charge of a group of patients and be responsible for all aspects of health and illness.
So one of the things that you cover in your book was your experience here at University of California, San Francisco, that I know you took with you also to Harvard. In thinking about future healthcare professionals and in tackling the issues about diversity, getting ready a group of healthcare professionals for our future that looks like the future of the population in this country. Can you say a few words about some of the lessons that you've learned and how you think about diversity in training future healthcare professionals?
Well, I feel very strongly about this. When I went to medical school, there were three women in my class. They were overachievers and wonderful people, but there were very few women in medicine. Today, 50% of our students are women, sometimes more than 50%. There's an impact on that, however, looking forward, that I think we have to recognize, and that is, on average, a woman graduate of medical school will be able to spend about 70 to 75% of her time in medicine, simply due to the burdens that are placed upon women in our society to raise families and to do the things that women often are asked to do and often want to do. In the case of underrepresented minorities, I think our medical schools have done exceptionally well over the past 25, 30 years. It's encouraging minority students to come to medical school, and UCSF and Harvard have among the best records in that category. And most of the students who come do very well. So I was very troubled when I was here when Prop 209 was passed, which essentially made affirmative action in admission practices at the undergraduate level, as we saw it unfold, have the impact that it did on the state of California, the education system here. I was very opposed to Proposition 209, and I understand that at the moment there is legislation being considered to reverse that, but unlikely to pass. We've been able to get around that to some degree in medicine because we interview our students. And each student who is considered for admission to medical school gets a private interview, and one can pick out talent in that way that doesn't have anything to do with quotas or saying we have to have so much of the class in one representation or another. I think diversity and affirmative action and gender issues are critical components of what the workforce should be going forward, and I have spent a bit of time in the book trying to describe my own experiences with that.
That's terrific. Well, I know you would all join me in giving great thanks to Dr. Joseph Martin, author of Alfalfa to Ivy, Memoir of a Harvard Medical School Dean, Today's program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by Bernard Osher Foundation. It's also been held in association with the Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Sue Desmond-Hellman, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.